Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I've found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. This is the word of the Lord. On the first pages of John Updike's novel, In the Beauty of the Lilies, a Presbyterian minister by the name of the Reverend Clarence Wilmot is standing in his book-lined study in the church manse. It's 1910. This is Paterson, New Jersey. And right there and then, he loses his faith. His wife is fixing dinner in the kitchen because the Building and Grounds Committee is coming over for dinner. And right there, standing in his study, poof, the faith just leaves the Reverend Clarence Wilmot. After Princeton Seminary, Reverend Wilmot pastored several different congregations across some 20 years of service to the church. But lately, he'd been reading the work of an atheist, this guy named Robert Ingersoll. Some of his parishioners had read this book and were confused and troubled by what they read. Ingersoll argued that once you come to grips with Freud's discoveries about the unconscious and how it works, after you come to grips with Darwin's new findings on the origin of the species, and with the latest biblical scholarship about how the Bible was actually stitched together, after all those discoveries, God no longer makes sense. Armed with this new learning, says Ingersoll, the sophisticated, thoughtful person no longer needs faith and no longer needs the church. Here's Updike's description of that experience with Clarence Wilmot. It happens on the third page of the novel. Quote, "At that moment, the Reverend Clarence Arthur Wilmot, down in the rectory of the Fourth Presbyterian Church at the corner of Straight Street and Broadway, felt the last particles of his faith leave him. The sensation was distinct, a visceral surrender, a set of dark, sparkling bubbles escaping upward." I give Updike credit for picturing the loss of faith in an interesting and pointed way. The person who loses his way here is a clergy person with much invested and with much to lose. So it's a story on one level about what can happen even to religious insiders. And it acknowledges as a novel that even faithful people lose the path. Now, from another angle, this scene that Updike creates, the scene of the minister standing there in his study, thinking about books, losing his faith, that's not usually how it goes down. An intellectual crisis is only one of the many different forms that losing the path can take. There are many other ways that we sometimes lose the path. Sometimes we wander away because we're ashamed of some failing, or we've compromised ourselves morally and we have a hard time facing that, or we've dealt with tragedy and loss and our hope flags and we yield to despair, or we struggle with mental illness and with depression and we find it hard to see any light in the world, or we lose confidence in God's goodness in the face of ongoing injustice all around us. Or we just get out of the habit of regular worship, and so this vision of the risen Christ, it loses its grip on our hearts and on our lives. Or we allow ourselves to be conformed to the values around us, values that aren't part of God's kingdom, things like racism or nationalism or greed or individualism or comfort or something else. There are 1,000 different ways to lose the path. There's one other serious problem with Updike's scene of the Reverend losing his faith. Updike imagines this loss as devastatingly final. The Reverend never comes back from this loss. It's an abrupt ending from which there's no hope of return. Updike imagines this loss of faith as an irretrievable loss, a fall from which the pastor will never recover. And while losing the path is a real threat for all of us here today, rarely is it final. And that's a point I will come back to in just a minute. Now turn back to our reading from Exodus. 3 months, just 3 months after their dramatic escape from slavery in Egypt, Israel comes through the desert to Mount Sinai. Here God will meet them and will give them the gift of the law, which for them will be a new way of life. Quote, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron, second in command, and said, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, it was great as long as it lasted, but we don't know what's happened to this guy." So Aaron, a bit of an idiot, grants their wishes. He asks them for their gold earrings. He melts them down. He forms them into a golden calf. "These are your gods," Aaron says to all the people, "your gods who brought you up out of Egypt." He builds an altar before the calf. He calls for a religious festival the next day, and they feast and they party before the golden calf. Meanwhile, cut to a scene on the top of the mountain between God and Moses. They're still up there. Deeply angry over this whole scene, God tells Moses of a plan to destroy all these Israelites, to make Moses into a great nation without all those unfaithful people. In response, Moses begs God to relent from this anger and to spare the people from destruction, and God relents. Here is a picture of God's beloved people losing their way. They're already on a pilgrimage out of a life of slavery into a life of freedom and a new gift of land, but they lose touch along the way. They lose touch with the God who rescued them, with the God who had promised them a future. What happened? I read this story several times this week, and I still find myself asking, what happened? What was their sin? How would you characterize it? Was it impatience? Was it restlessness? Was it fickleness? Was it dullness? Was it forgetfulness? Was it that they wanted some physical symbol of the power of God? Did they need some kind of certainty? I'm not sure. Part of the story is that God charges them with idolatry. That's verse 8. And refers to them as a stiff-necked people. That's verse 9. The truth is that Israel frequently gets lost. They lose the path over and over again. And so it's not surprising that Jesus, the Jewish rabbi, tells stories about getting lost and getting found. The big questions for Jesus listeners are big questions for us too. Who's lost and who's found? What does it mean to be lost or found or welcomed back home? And what does it mean to be a community of God's hospitality and grace? All these questions are in the air as Jesus tells these stories. Now, on one level, these parables of lost sheep and lost coins are about lost people. That's what Bob was getting at with our young kids. They're about the sinners whom Jesus welcomes and with whom he gladly and scandalously eats dinner. One commentator I read refers to him as a promiscuous meal sharer. I like that. But on another level, these stories challenge all those others who see themselves, and maybe this is us, see themselves as safe and sound. Jesus tells these stories to unsettle those of us who are comfortable, to help even religious folks, churchy folks, discover that we're just as lost as those that we generally label terrible sinners. Now, once we begin to see ourselves as the lost, as those who've lost their way, as those who regularly keep losing the way, we break through into a new view of who we are. We can finally see ourselves as people deeply in need of God's kindness, God's mercy, God's forgiveness. But then something else happens too. When we see ourselves as radically dependent on God's grace, our view of other people is also transformed. They're no longer strangers, but friends, suffering from the same temptations and distortions as are we. They're not some categorically different kind of people who need to be saved by those of us who are already found. No, they become fellow sufferers who can gladly be welcomed into our hearts, into our lives, and into this congregation. Now let me come back to why Updike's scene of Reverend Wilmot losing his faith may not be all that helpful to us in the long run. In actual fact, people lose their way all the time. Sometimes losing your way looks like losing your faith, but not always. Losing the path isn't a rare and occasional event, and I say this as a pastor. It's not a rare and occasional thing, happening only in extreme circumstances to a few people now and then. Getting lost is actually the background rhythm to our whole lives, both personally and collectively as a congregation. Getting off track, losing the way, bending aside into unhealthy habits, sliding quietly into unbelief, letting go of a life-shaping trust in the good news. These are all normal, even daily challenges in the life of faith. Being honest and upfront with ourselves about how prone we are to lose the path is the vigilant first step towards an openness to something new, to change and renewal. More often than not, losing the path is not a final life-defining loss, as it is in Updike's novel. Often it's a clearing of debris, a letting go of something shallow and non-essential, a leaving behind of forms of religious habit and spirituality that might have served one earlier in life but does so no longer. When these kinds of losses happen, there's something fresh and new that can grow in their wake, something more honest and more real. Some of us have been through periods of life when it felt like we lost our faith. Some of us may feel like that this morning, even as we sit here. We might look back wistfully to times in our lives when things felt easier, when we could believe and trust and pray quite naturally. But now all that has slipped away. We keep hanging on, but with the nagging sense that something's been lost or something's gotten broken in us. I hear these stories all the time. People confide in me that they think they've lost their faith. They're not sure if they believe anymore. They can't commit themselves to things that don't make sense anymore. These are very common testimonies. Many of us have been through these periods, and by periods, I mean these may make up the majority of your life, to be honest. But here's what I want you to consider this morning. The feeling that you've lost some connection to past forms of faith may actually be a wonderful sign that your life is unfolding towards something new. It might mean that on some deep level, you're recognizing that what you used to believe and how you used to believe it won't work for you anymore. It means that you're tired of artificially twisting your heart and your life, pretending to believe religious teachings or supposed truths that have lost their grip for you. And releasing these things, letting go of them, that often feels like losing your faith. But it's not the same thing at all. It's actually a process of growth and discovery. The unnecessary features of your faith and your spirituality are actually being burned away or chiseled off or taken from you. And that process, that experience can feel very scary because often you don't know what's coming next or if anything's coming next. The point of reflecting together this morning on how often we lose our way is simply to remember once again that God is always with us in our failings and in our distortions. To remember that God is patient and merciful in repeatedly calling us back to lives of faith, hope, and love. It's never over. The clock never runs out. We get far more than three strikes. It's not over for us. It's not over for people we consider big, terrible sinners. It's not even over for those we consider our enemies. There's always hope. The changes we're experiencing as a congregation are challenging, of course, but they're also interesting and I think exciting. We're becoming a community for people who don't want the standard religious answers that used to make sense. We're becoming a welcoming family for people who've tried obeying the rules and conforming to the expectations of their religious upbringing, and it didn't work. And they need something new and different. We're becoming a place where it's okay to be lost. It's okay to be unsure. It's okay to be confused. A place where it's okay to take your time, to ask questions, to sift through a variety of possible lives, to experiment, and to try out new forms of spirituality and discipleship. Friends, our readings today call us to be a joyful community. We're to party together, to rejoice together, to have fun together, to share meals together. We're to be a place with wide open doors where there's always an air of festivity. Those who find us will find a place of glad hospitality and joyful welcome. Those who find us will find a place where all the different parts of their lives, however difficult, are welcomed and included. Those who find us feel like they've finally made their way back home. What's lost is found, and we all cheer for one another as we find the path again and again. Amen.